Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Panning the Stream with Dan Reichert. Say hi, Dan.
That's me. Hello.
And Bianca, that's me. Bianca Reichert's my full name. Well, my full name is not. I have a middle name, too.
Yeah. So it's just your first and last name when it comes down to it.
So this week we watched Explained. Is it a Vice thing? No, it's not Vice.
It's a Vox thing.
Vox.
It's a Netflix show, but it's a Vox production.
Yeah, Netflix original. Called Explain, and every episode are just little bite-sized explanations of things that, you know, tend to elude the common people. And we decided to watch two episodes on subjects that we are wholly unfamiliar with. Well, maybe one more than the other. And they were cricket and the stock market. And I think the way we should do this, Dan, is that we'll both give our interpretations of the subject and, you know, just go off from there. Based on what we've learned from the show.
And also, if you listened last week, you know that we did a thing where we eschewed our normal
notes were eschewed.
Notes were eschewed. I don't know how to pronounce that right. But we normally take notes about the shows. So we don't forget things. But we thought it'd be fun to watch both of these things, remember what we can with no notes, and then record a thing a day later and see how much we have retained. So we literally have – I have no notes open here or anything. I usually have a whole bunch.
Right.
So let's explain the stock market and cricket.
Okay. So where do you want to start? You want to start
Why don't you take lead on the stock market here? Because that's the one that maybe I have invested in stuff for over 10 years now in the stock market.
Okay.
And I at least have a basic understanding of numbers go up, numbers go down. You buy money, you want to sell it when it's higher.
All right. So you want me, this is what the show taught me.
Okay.
Now, I don't know whether or not this is true. It might not even be what the show said, but this is what I remember.
Good start.
Okay.
All right. So Dracula was...
So back in the olden days, there were a handful of really wealthy people. The Roosevelt, the Vanderbilts.
The Rockefellers.
The Rockefellers. The other name.
Carnegies.
Now, these were railroad people. They were industrialists, wealthy industrialists.
Oil folk.
Oil barons, yes. Eventually, it came to reason that, communities should be put into the mix instead of these guys operating with free rein. And, the the fact that there were these industrial things means that, small businesses were popping up in communities and stuff like that. And for people to grow their small businesses, if they didn't have investors or they didn't have, a ton of capital to work with, they would sell pieces of their company to shareholders. And the shareholders were generally common people, not exceptionally wealthy people, but they can still afford to own a small chunk of the company, right?
I think that's the abstract thing that has always eluded me about the stock market is like, what are you owning? It's like they depict it as like, a piece of paper saying like, hey, you own this. But like,
well, I mean, you're owning in the sense that like when you go to pay for something, you then own that thing. I mean, you're owning a chunk of it so that the people who make the choices about the company have to consider you and have to do what's best for the people that – the shareholders, the people that own it and their communities and long-term goals. At least that's how it was in the beginning.
I'll say one thing that still eludes me though is that like I don't know if it's like, okay, we've decided to do an IPO, initial public offering. Is there a finite amount of shares where it's like, okay, our company has 10,000 shares? Because you always hear like, oh, this person has 51% of the shares in the company. So that makes me think that there's got to be a finite amount of shares to hand out.
Well,
but this didn't really cover that.
I think that the more shares there are, the less the shares are worth. That's why they mention how a lot of companies now will spend a lot of their revenue on buybacks so that they can buy up the existing shares so there are fewer shares, and that kind of artificially inflates the cost of the shares.
Right. And I know there's something too that happens a lot. Like I buy a lot of stocks that just like, oh, hopefully this blows up, and then it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of times, though, you'll look at the thing and it'll be like, oh my God, the stock price went up by 300%. And then it turns out it was like a reverse split, which means that they like consolidated a bunch of shares
or
something.
We're not going to get into the nitty gritty here.
That's what I'm saying. It doesn't cover a lot of that stuff. This is kind of like, obviously, it's like 15 minutes long.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I get it's really broad strokes and I should be able to understand all of it, but here we are.
I'm not saying you should understand all of it. I'm saying we had 15
so
minutes.
So anyway, Daniel. So initially, this was very beneficial to communities because the companies were motivated to make choices in the best interest of the communities and of long-term goals for society and you know, the environment or whatever. And then this guy named Milton Friedman came around, and he was an economist that kind of had some, at the time, controversial views that were widely celebrated by businesses.
You remember his name with no notes?
Milton Friedman?
How do you remember his name?
Well, I've heard his name before.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
He's a 70s guy, right?
Yeah.
They showed him going on the news and stuff.
He was, yeah, whatever. So his whole shtick was that the only responsibility that companies have is to work in the interest of the shareholders, as in like profits, doing whatever they can, whether that's making just purely short-term goals, whatever they can to make the shareholders as much money as possible, to increase the dividends, which is, you know, a shareholder is getting paid out to, I guess, as a show of good faith. I don't know.
Well, dividend, not all stocks have dividends, but some are dividend stocks that mm-hmm. like, you know, a few times a year or whatever will be like, okay, you're getting this percent of your stuff back or whatever.
And I know that's why, like, when people say, you know, you hear CEOs, oh, the CEO didn't take any salary because the company was in trouble and he wanted to make sure his employees get paid. But really, he's getting paid with dividends. So it's not like it's this nice kindness of your heart kind of thing.
Because would the CEO always necessarily have shares in the company? Or is I guess it'd be possible, right, to just have a salary and not – like they say it's usually tied to the mm-hmm. stock price. They showed mm-hmm. that bar graph where it's like, okay, we'll usually make this much based on this. And it goes up and down with the stock price or something. But I wonder if you could be a CEO and not have shares.
I don't know. Maybe. I don't know, Dan.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Look at me. I majored in animation.
Wait, we're both working this out here. Neither of us understand this. That's why we're both watching it.
Anyway, so this Milton Friedman guy made all these business people really excited because they were like, oh, well, we can do you know, everything we want to do that just benefits us, and we don't have to worry about what the community, what society is going to think, what the community is going to think, what our smaller shareholders are going to think. And in doing so, they kind of fuck the small people over. Now we've gotten to the point where companies kind of most of their operations are done with the sole intention of benefiting shareholders. And like what I mentioned about stock buybacks before, instead of investing that money into things that will benefit people long term, or, you know, making choices that might not have immediate benefits for the company, but might down the road, you know, things that will improve the company, make it, you know, give it longevity or whatever. Instead of doing that, they're taking that money and putting it into stock buybacks because all they're concerned about is the value of their stock.
Yeah, we saw a lot of stuff from people saying that like, okay, well, because of people following this, I don't know if it's all the Milton Friedman stuff or that method, but it seems like it's still a case now where companies are so focused on like the quarter or whatever, right, like to whatever to like boost, you know, during an investor call or mm-hmm. something, say, oh, things are great and boost the price instead of, yeah, thinking long term and doing stuff like, you know, raising wages and stuff right. like that. And
now because they're so, you know, they're buying back stocks and everything, stock owning stock is now not something that people really associate with the average person. Now it's more of a kind of like, you know, if you own stocks, you're probably doing well. You know, yeah. It's not something that just anyone can own.
Yeah, they showed a bar graph of like over the decades of like percentage of the U.S. population that owned stocks. And it was like in the 60s or 70s decades ago. And now it's like under 30 or I'm sorry, like 50, 53, something like that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's gone down dramatically.
Right, right. And it just seems to be one of those things that, you know, capitalism has some really shitty effects, especially when you keep going in one direction and dig a hole further and further, because I feel like a lot of the times, you know, money is prioritized over people's well-being and everything like that.
Yeah, they showed some stuff from like that paper mill and everything where those people were at work and everything.
Sad.
That was super sad, yeah.
And that just seemed like such an arbitrary thing. Like literally all they wanted to do was just make it so they can make as much money as possible, you know, the community be damned. That really, and that, and something like that in that particular case, like that paper mill was obviously one of those things where, most of the people you meet in the small town probably work for that paper mill. It's a cornerstone of the whole town, whatever. And then this big, you know, company buys it up and then turns it into this, you know, just everyone loses their job. It's a tragedy. It really is. And that's the thing, what you forget about when, you know, people talk about greed and all this stuff. You know, a lot of people roll their eyes. But it's like, you forget that this is people's lives. And these people have families and children and, you know, and lives like where they've devoted years to this one particular thing. And then for it to just be taken from them so that, I hate to say it's so cliche, but so rich people can get even richer. It's really sad. You know, it's really fucking tragic.
Yeah. And even with this thing kind of explaining some terms and concepts and stuff that I only had maybe a loose grasp of before, mm-hmm. it definitely just solidified to me that, like, this is complicated stuff. Like, economic stuff is something I've always struggled to understand.
Sure.
Like, you know, I like capitalism only because I've not heard of something that sounds better, but
that's so appealing is just the idea that people will be benefited for the hard work that they do.
Yeah, like the American dream, like come over here, work really hard, and you'll make something of yourself.
Yeah, but unfortunately, I don't know if there's such thing as a perfect system, but unfortunately, like so many people suffer. It's like the beginning was okay, and then it just got people figure things out and figure out how to, you know, just make more and, you know, other people be damned. And I feel like people stop caring about society as a whole at some point.
It's got to be so complicated because, like, if there was a perfect system or something for economic mm-hmm. stuff, like, every country would do it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, I like capitalism, but there are stories and stuff, like what you see with this paper mill and the way the stock market has been, you know, gets manipulated and stuff and CEO pay mm-hmm. and everything that seems, like, incredibly unfair. Mm-hmm.
What they said about CEO pay, like, how back in the day, the average CEO would make, like, was it 10 or 20 times more?
It was, like, 22 times more, and then it was, like, 230 times more.
And nowadays, it's 230 times. I can't even fathom that.
Like, yeah, like, that type of shit. Like, I'm all for, like, you know, if somebody founds a company or runs a company and does a good job, they deserve to be paid very well. But, like, when we're talking, like, that level of, like, 240 times, you know.
It's crazy. And, you know, we live in the Upper East Side. We're in an area where there's tons of unbelievably wealthy people. And it's like, you know, these people, they definitely devote probably most of their lives. You know, people, you always hear about people who, like, oh, you know, their life is their work or whatever.
Yeah.
And they're preoccupied with things that might not make any difference to us, but to them, it's their whole world. But the average person also has a full-time job, whatever. Maybe their job isn't their life, but in some cases, maybe it is. But the discrepancy is so massive that, like, it's just, you cannot justify it. It's we're not talking like twice as much pay or three times as much pay. It's an amount of money that the average person couldn't spend in a lifetime. I mean, it's, why is that necessary when you could inject that into the community and, you know, have everyone benefit? But unfortunately, it's like, even that's not that easy because, you know, it's so weighed down by, like, so many different organizations and so much, like, red tape and all this bullshit that even something as nice as that, when people do, you know, put money back in the community, like, even that isn't just, like, you know, going directly there. It's like, oh, there's just so much bullshit. Nothing's as easy as it seems, and it's just, it's really sad. It really is sad.
And it sucks, too, because, like, these CEOs that are making 240 times more than the average worker, like, I don't know, like, growing up, I was surrounded by very kind of blue-collar, like, mm-hmm. hey, these are people that work at grocery stores, or, you know, they're delivering mail, mm-hmm. or they're, you know, farmers and things like that. They were not CEOs and business people and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you're just working at a grocery store or a gas station or something, or a movie theater or a cell phone store mm-hmm. or something, you're still working long hours, and, like, that shit's not easy. Like, I've worked tons of register jobs. I've worked tons of retail and stuff. I've worked call centers, shit mm-hmm. that just, like, man, you work 40 hours a week doing that stuff, and it drains you. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it's less rewarding and harder work in a lot of cases than a lot of CEOs that can kind of just make hours or whatever and coast off stuff. Obviously, you know, every company is going to be different. Every CEO's duties are going to be different. But, like, yeah, these people that are getting paid scrap compared to the CEOs
it's just harder
a lot of times.
How much is enough at a certain point? It's like when you talk about, you know, people like fucking Jeff Bezos, who has $160 billion or something ludicrous like that. How much is enough? Like, at what point can you be like, all right, I have enough for myself and my family and my future, my kids' futures, whatever. I'm going to give the rest back or whatever. You know, if that money went to employees, they'd be so much better off.
Yeah.
And Amazon wouldn't have the reputation that it would have. I mean, maybe not as bad as it would be.
Yeah, and that's a point, too, where it's like, there is a line at some point where it's like, I am all about the American dream of just like, hey, work hard. Hey, make yourself rich. You know, get a fucking sweet house and be able to afford whatever you want. That's great. You earn that. You know, you work hard and you earn that. But like you said, like, you know, like Bezos money, like $160 billion or something like that. Like, I don't think anybody really needs that exactly.
Oh, no. I think most people wouldn't even need $1 billion. I mean,
yeah.
And it's obviously he is exceptionally, like, crazily wealthy, but all the people that tag behind him in the Forbes, like, top 10 wealthiest people also have, like, crazy amounts of billions of dollars.
Yeah.
And it's like these small, this, like, handful of people that are controlling everything. And it's only going to get worse. It really is. Because consider, you know, this documentary looks back, or this documentary, this show, like, looks back at how it was. And just to see it kind of devolve into where it is now over a relatively short amount of time. I mean, we're talking that Milton Friedman till now is only, like, 50 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's nothing. It's troubling. It really is.
Yeah. And, you know, occasionally you will see these people that are, you know, near the top of the, like, Forbes stuff, like the Warren Buffetts and the Bill Gates that, like, are known for being extremely charitable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know Gates in particular has been known to do, like, he's, from what I've heard, he is charitable in the way that is not for show. He takes on a lot of, like, you know, unsexy causes and doesn't publicize it necessarily, or, hey, look at me and how much
malaria,
good I'm doing.
Right? That's his big thing.
Is that what the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is?
I know that's, it, like, cornerstone of the foundation, if not the whole goal of it.
I feel like I've only, like, again, I cannot tell you what all their money goes towards, but I've always heard that, like, Gates and Buffett especially are extremely charitable. Mm-hmm. So, like, but you can't expect even most, like, super billionaires to be like that. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. It sucks. Like, I'm no socialist or anything, but, like, yeah, like you say, you know, the people that are making hundreds of billions of dollars or whatever, it does seem excessive. I don't fucking know what the answer is.
There has to be a way for the people that work really hard to be able to comfortably put food on the table for their family.
Yeah, that shouldn't be an issue.
It shouldn't be an issue.
If you're working 40 hours a week and you're doing your job and you're consistent and everything, you should be able to, like, have a family and in a decent way of life. So, stock market seems kind of fucked.
Yeah.
But it also seems fucked.
And so this little thing, obviously I've probably gotten most of those facts wrong, but if nothing else, it really taught me about how much it has changed over – it's relatively new. So since its inception till now, it kind of has evolved to be more – less about the people and more about, you know, the best interest of the shareholders.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting. I recommend watching it. It's easily digestible. I would definitely have to watch it again to fully absorb everything. But
yeah.
we kind of wanted to test ourselves here. So Dan, can you tell me about cricket?
I would love to tell you about cricket.
Hold that thought, Dan.
Okay.
Let's talk home goods.
Home goods? Like, for our home here in New York City?
Goods for your home, that's right. Decor, furniture, stuff that most people get from big box stores.
What if I want something more high-end with its own identity?
I think you should go to The Citizenry.
Oh yeah? What do they have there?
The Citizenry has globally inspired premium home decor, crafted in the Peruvian Andes and other really exotic, awesome places, by hand, made to order.
We actually have a couple things from The Citizenry here. We have a throw blanket, and we also have a lumbar pillow, and let me say, they are both delightful and comfortable, and obviously a lot of care and handcrafted work went into making these.
You could just tell these were made by hand.
Yes, absolutely.
They're too delicate, the textures are too intricate to be made by some machine.
Well, how about this? How about if I have a belated housewarming gift for the folks at home listening?
Oh my gosh, do you?
I do. You see, for everyone at home, for your first order, The Citizenry is offering a $50 gift voucher towards your purchase of over $200. If you go to citizenrypodcast.com/stream today and use promo code STREAM to redeem this special offer just for podcast listeners, that is code STREAM at citizenrypodcast.com/stream for $50 towards your purchase of $200 or more. One more time, that is citizenrypodcast.com/stream. Use code STREAM. All right, so cricket. It's basically, this is going to be the same conversation we had about the stock market. Mm-hmm. It's confusing in a different way. Okay.
So can you tell me a little bit about what you knew about cricket prior to watching this?
Yes. We did a video, me and Jeff Gerstmann did a video with Danny O'Dwyer about cricket.
Danny O'Dwyer.
Yes.
One of the best dudes.
Danny O'Dwyer is a fantastic dude. We assumed since he was from Europe that he would understand cricket. I think he's more of a soccer guy, but he did his best. It's been a few years now, but I didn't retain anything from that video game. Basically, there are two fellas, and they face each other in the middle of a pitch, And there's one that's called, like, Long John's or something that's, like, the most famous one in the world. And that's where it started in England or whatever. And so the two fellas on the same team are facing each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're the batters. And then there's also, there's a bunch of fielders in this big oval around them.
Right.
And all the fielders, they're called some British thing. I don't think they're called fielders. But so there's just, like, 11 fielders surrounding them.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's one that's like, it's called a bowler or something, that is down on the fucking middle part with them. And they throw the ball and, oh God, it gets confusing. Okay, so ideally, if you're one of the batters or fucking whatever they're called, the cricket men, you hit the ball and you don't hit it. Like, if a fielder catches it, like in baseball, you're out.
Mm.
But if you can get it past them, both of the fellas on the same team run to the other side, to the other person's wicket. And if they both cross the line before the fielder has the ball and throws it and knocks a dumb thing off the wicket, you get a run or a point or a tally-ho or whatever
breaks,
they call it.
Isn't there some kind of penalty if the wicket breaks?
No, if they hit the wicket, the bad guys, the opposing team gets a point or gets, no, they get an out or an over.
So these guys run back and forth for up to 5 days.
Yes, that's the thing. I've always heard that it was long, but apparently the traditional way of playing cricket.
The test match was
up to 5 days because they had to get six over. Or no, it was like, no. You have to get like six bad pitches or something before you get an over, and you have to get like 50 overs or something to end the game. Okay, but you can also not swing at a pitch if you're on the batting team, which is cool. It's like getting a ball in baseball, as long as it doesn't hit the wicket. Because if it hits the wicket, I think that's an out or an over or something. But, so basically, it's just like a ball in baseball. If you think it's going wide or something, or if it's off the mark, you can let it pass without worrying about it, as long as it doesn't hit the wicket.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you get a run every time you run past the line. If you get it past a certain point in the oval, you get some points extra. If you hit it over this line, you get extra points.
Yeah. Why? Why do they have to do all this stuff?
I mean, I guess if you lived in a country that didn't no other country really gives a shit about American football for the most part. And I'm sure if you explained all the weird rules in that, it would seem arbitrary.
No.
What?
No.
What?
Dan, cricket takes it to a whole other level. Are you kidding?
The 5 day thing is bonkers.
I mean, time aside, it's just all the rules and stuff. It's bonkers.
I mean, but there are a ton of rules in football, you know?
Yeah, but cricket is more complicated.
Cricket does seem especially complicated. Like, Stephen Fry is in the show, and he is kind of talking about all the different ways you can get out or an over or whatever. And it just sounds like there's a million weird little ways. Like, if the judges determine one thing, or if this stupid thing happens, or if one other. Like, it seems like a whole lot.
Yes.
That's the basic rules of my understanding. And then, like, the second half of this explained show went into something I did not even know was a thing, which is T20 cricket. Which is like, they're trying to like WrestleMania up cricket.
Okay, so we have to talk about something I didn't know about cricket. Well, I mean, I didn't know anything about cricket. But when I thought about it, I always thought about British people,
mm-hmm.
you know, fancy British people. I mm-hmm. mean, for God's sakes, there's a tea break.
Yes.
Or at least there was. What I didn't know is that apparently India.
Yeah.
They're like the foremost cricket players to the point where the best cricket players would go to play for the Indian League.
Yeah, and that like the first time they made it to the World Cup in England or whatever, like England, like all these like old English dudes.
That
were,
was before the T20 stuff was introduced.
That's
and then
right.
Once the T20 stuff was introduced, they kind of capitalized on the fact that it was like this bite-sized thing, and they made it more of a spectacle, and they gave it storylines. It was kind of like they really wrestled it up.
Well, so it's shorter, so they would basically be capped at like 3 hours. But right. What do you mean by like storylines?
Well, when they were talking about how, like, in India, they kind of fuse the daytime drama with T20 format. So there'd be, like, so much drama and stuff, and there'd be different characters and everything. Did you not see that?
Characters?
Yeah.
I mean, I saw all the stuff where they would have, like, cheerleader-type things, and they'd have music videos mm-hmm. and things like that, but I feel like what you're describing is more like you're talking about like written storylines.
Well, I mean, I'm not. It's not a one for one. It's wrestling. I'm not talking about written story, but there's just the drama and the spectacle.
Yeah, it was way more like pomp and circumstance. I think they interview some guy in the crowd who says something like, "Oh, I'm not a big fan of all the." I don't know if he says razzmatazz. Is that what he says?
That's exactly what he says. Because I remember I stapled that into my mind.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of like posh old timer traditionalist cricket fans were just like, "Ugh, their fireworks and their cheerleaders and their songs and all that stuff." And like when they did their first like. I think World Cup or something, guys were doing weird stuff with their hair and stuff. Like, it just seemed like...
They weren't really taking it seriously. And some of the people commented on how they would even, like, drink during the games because it was such a, like, a lax thing.
But it seems like it blew up. Like, it got super-duper popular, and understandably so, because, like, that seems like it makes it way more accessible. Like, they talked about doing a survey of, like, oh, hey, why are the reasons you've never attended a thing? And, like, so many people were like, well, it's just a length thing. And then, so all of a sudden, like, it made cricket way sexier to advertisers, and it started bringing in way more fans, you know, buying tickets and everything. And so, I mean, if that's where the money is and that's where the fans are, like, it does seem like there was this huge kind of seismic shift towards T20 in the last, what, 10 or 20 years or something like that. And honestly, just not knowing shit about cricket, like, I would probably not ever sit down and watch a match that could go 5 days. But hey, if I felt like it, I could watch a 3-hour game and you know, like a World Cup game or something and see how it goes. Like, it just seems way more accessible. Yeah. We're not going to. We're not going to watch cricket, but like I would rather sit down for a thing.
Oh, come on. Yeah, of course. If I'm going to watch something where I have no idea what's going on, I'd rather it be 3 hours than 5 days.
Yeah, that's a crazy opinion you've got there.
5 days is a really long time.
It really is a long time. They didn't really say like how long those days are, because obviously it's not 24 hours.
I don't know.
Like, is it 8-hour limit? I don't really know how that works. But yeah, like, I don't know, like some of those like song and dance numbers and stuff seemed kind of fun and silly. And, like I really like the enthusiasm that India had, just for cricket. Like, it just seems like that just became a fucking thing in India. And I thought that was pretty cool.
That was their thing.
Yeah. So that was basically the things, the basic rules I understand of cricket, and also that T20 is a thing, and they made it shorter and more palatable to the masses.
Test matches, one day matches, and then T20.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting. I didn't really absorb any of the rules of the actual game, but learning about its cultural impact and its kind of evolution into something that was so distinctly European to the point where it was spreading outside of India. So like outside, there was Indian variations of it, which was really interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
I always thought it was this purely British thing.
Yeah, and how they said that like it super never took on here because like it reminded people of England. And it's like, well, no, we got our independence. We're not going to fucking play that game.
Oh, yeah. And the fact that too, a lot of the countries that would compete, it wouldn't be so much just like the game, but it would be like an anti-colonialist, like fuck you Britain kind of thing. Like it was really interesting.
I do think, you know, neither of us are huge sports people, but I do like it when sports stories can carry like a bigger weight than just like, oh hey, this team beat this team. And, I think that's a pretty cool story.
Like what was that famous Russian
the miracle
hockey match?
Yeah, the do you believe in miracles Kurt Russell thing. Yeah, I don't know. I think it was like an Olympics thing, and it was during the Cold War, and I think America won a hockey match, and it was a big thing where we all hugged and, oh, America's cool.
Now, the Cold War wasn't actually a war, right? It was just
a decades-long...
it was like they're doing the dance, but there was no...
Just a lot of constant worry about getting nuked, and I think that's why it's called the Cold War. It never really, like, you know, it was this just kind of chilly, like, relationship.
Is that why it was called the Cold War?
Well, just relations between the countries were like cool or cold and chilly, and there wasn't
I wish everyone would just get along.
Yeah, things are complicated. It turns out we need a Netflix show to explain things to us in 15 minutes. Yeah. And I'm sure we understand everything about the stock market.
I mean,
and
now I'm a stock market and cricket expert.
I would say we know a small percentage more about both things. Mm. Although cricket, I would say I knew literally almost nothing about. So cricket, I think my understanding went up more thanks to the show.
Oh, you know what I was going to say? I think it's Milton Friedman who had some like idea for an island or something. Or maybe he actually had an island where there was just like a universal tax rate that was super low. And it didn't work out for him.
I feel like there have been like presidential candidates and stuff who have been like had universal tax plans or whatever. Like, hey, everyone's going to pay 10% or whatever. Is that Herman Cain? Yeah. I don't know how the fuck taxes work.
I am America.
The remember commercial?
That? Yeah. One voice, united with... It just slowly zooms in on Jim's face.
Smiling and like
so
nodding.
That was so bonkers.
I always thought if I was in charge of his marketing, I would do an ad that was, here I am, rock you like a Herman Cain.
Oh my God, yes. Right. Oh, that would have been perfect.
Yes. All right. So we learned a little bit. Yes. I like the idea of this Netflix show where it's like, hey, you got 15 minutes. You want to learn a little bit more about something you never knew before? Here you go.
And I think some of the other episodes were, what are some of the other ones? They talked about cryptocurrency.
Yes. Cryptocurrency. There's one on astrology.
Oh, yeah. Astrology. And there's a lot of different things. It really runs the gamut. So check it out if you ever just want something interesting to put on the background.
Yeah, I thought it was a fun thing, and I think I did learn a few things.
Yeah,
so.
It really makes it approachable and accessible. I mean, like, even the stock market one, they had, like, children playing out kind of how it works, which was helpful.
Yeah. All right, so that'll be it for this week. Next week, we are going to watch on Netflix. It is a new film by the Coen brothers, which we are pretty big Coen fans here.
The Coen brothers.
They are fantastic.
They make good movies.
They did The Fargo, The Big Lebowski.
Fargo, A Serious Man.
The Raising Arizona.
Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yep. Lots of great ones that we have personally enjoyed.
Yes.
And so they made an anthology Western on Netflix. You may have heard of it. It's called The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. I believe my understanding is that it's like six different stories set in the Old West. Liam Neeson's in it. James Franco's in it. But yeah, it is a full-on written and directed by Joel and
now,
Ethan
Daniel,
Coen.
This is movie length, right?
Yeah, this is like a 2-hour, 10-minute long thing. Yep. Mm-hmm. But it'll be like six stories within.
Cool.
So we will we'll watch that and we'll discuss our favorite stories from that. That'll be next week. To wrap up this week, I want to thank everyone that's involved with our listener support program. Yes, thank you. If you want to support the podcast, if you like Painting the Stream, go to paintingthestream.com. You can click support this podcast and you can help us out with $1, $5, $10 a month, or you can just do a one-time thing and cancel. It's not a big deal at all. And Bonk, do you have a haiku for somebody who is helping us out?
Daniel, I do. And there's a person named Wesley. I'm just going to assume it's a man because Wesley's generally man's name.
Yes.
And Wesley, I wrote you a haiku. If you don't mind, please giving me your ear for just a moment and I will share with you my art. Okay. Once there was Wesley. The sky was blue again and the flowers were bright.
The sky was blue again. Wait, the sky was blue. That's six.
The sky was blue again and...
Wait, I think you might be cheating on these haikus.
Well, you know what? There's no rules other than the 5-7-5 thing, right?
I thought there was like I thought each one is a phrase that ends.
I don't know.
I don't think you can put the and on the third line.
This isn't some paint by numbers poetry, Dan.
Okay,
this is real art, man. I'm pouring my soul into this.
This is a bonk coup.
Yeah.
Okay, you make your
Once
own rules.
Once there was Wesley, the sky was blue again and the flowers were bright. That says a lot about Wesley. He must be a really amazing person.
All right, well, those are beautiful words, and so even if it's not the traditional format, I hope Wesley enjoyed your art, honey.
Yes. My art and my heart.
Yes.
And my fart.
Yes. So if you want to give us feedback, you can email us.
Wait, do you
us.
Have any recommendations?
Oh, yeah. Get a nice sound machine or an app that
Ooh,
does
you
it.
You love those.
And do some thunderstorm sounds, some rain sounds when you go to bed. It's a nice thing.
Sometimes I feel like, and Dan, I'm sure you can relate to this, when I'm laying in bed at night, the complete and utter silence, from that I will create sounds that scare me. Like I'll be like, oh, was that wind? Someone climbing up our fire escape? Like,
right.
So the sound machine really helps to kind of keep those at bay.
It helps mask the intruders that are coming in to kill you. Yes. Mm-hmm. All right. Do you have a suggestion?
I do. So I watched a film yesterday I spoke to you about earlier called Out of Sight. It's a Steven Soderbergh movie from the late 90s starring George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez. And it's Soderbergh's first movie with Clooney. It's very good. It's sad. It's fun. It's Lopez and Clooney have like insane chemistry together.
Huh.
Yeah, it's really good. And check it out if you're into crime, spy, love stories.
Yeah, I heard it's based on an Elmore Leonard novel, which I used to read some of his books, and I thought those were fun. I heard good things about the movie. Thanks for the recommendation.
Yeah.
So if you want to email us suggestions, recommendations, anything like that, we're at paintingthestream@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at panthestream. And I think that's about it. You can review us on iTunes if you want. Give us the old 5 stars.
Yes,
let us know what you think.
Do.
Thanks to Tom Londa for the theme song.
Oh, that's my brother.
That's your
God
brother.
I love him.
And Bonk, thank you as always for sitting here and joining me for this podcast.
Well, thanks to you, babe, for being just a quality guy and a good friend and just a champ, an all-around champ.
Well, thanks, honey. And thanks to the folks at home. We will join you next week with The Ballad of Buster Scruggs on Netflix.
Bye, guys.
Goodbye.